there's been a gap between this album, Run With Me, and the last. What led up to this album being made?
So the biggest thing was I think I was just working a lot. I was working and I was a parent, and like 5-6 years ago, I just started to feel like I wasn't doing anything really well. I was passively doing a bunch of stuff and I was kind of overwhelmed and tired, and just felt like I could maybe set music aside and that be the thing that would cause the least damage if I stopped doing, you know? So so that happened. And then again, like the pandemic happened and things just seemed really up in the air and confusing. And I don't think anybody knew how we were gonna make music, you know, in the future. And then, so there was this big gap. And I love my job, and I really worked, like, I like what I do at CFRU, you know, working with people, sort of not, like, trying to take up a bit less space, because I get to take up plenty of space for years, and help other folks learn how to use the technology to express themselves and share their perspectives. And so that became more important and more of a focus, which is great, especially through the pandemic when people were disconnected and alienated and isolated. It became more and more important to me. Then at the beginning of this year, I had a lot of personal change all of a sudden. And I won't go into the details of it, but it was created a situation where I just felt like I needed an outlet, and I started to sing again just for the act of singing. And I really started to love the physical feeling of singing again. I had forgotten that feeling. So I would just go into a little space in the backyard and sing and learn songs that I had written a long time ago, or, you know, just try and even learn Michael Hurley songs or, whatever, like just stuff that was enjoyable to sing. And then so and that turned into writing some stuff again as an outlet. And then I started to sketch out and record little scratches of songs. And then I sent those to friends that I hadn't reached out to in years from, you know, the last 25 years of making music. And everybody came through. People just added stuff at home. Some folks came to my place and recorded. Nate Lohr recorded drums. Nate, who's on like the Live at Massey record and was in the Providers for years. And Aaron Goldstein, Anna Ruddick, Tom Hamerton, Rich Burnett, and then like older friends like Julie Doiron and Daniel Romano. Most of the Cons play on the record. And a band that I had, like the first single that we put out is Thunder Bay, which was a recording of a band called the Harbor Coats that I had in Montreal in like 2009. That band, like, that was the earlier versions of a lot of the songs on the other records, like Rivers of Gold and Translator and Positive People and stuff. The original versions of those were done with the Harbor Coats, so this was sort of a real reaching back, and they all were really supportive and let me use that recording. Yeah, so it's been a kind of reaching out, you know, and it's turned out really lovely. I'm not a person that was very good at asking for help in a lot of situations, especially in kind of tougher times, and that has been an exercise in that, you know, and people really coming through.
So you're talking about the first single, Thunder Bay. So like, you recorded that back in 2009, and did you kind of add to it, or?
It's almost entirely as it was then, but I redid the vocal because I just wanted it to sound closer to what the rest of the record sounded like. So I redid the lead vocal for it, and that's it. But yeah, it's all the original folks from the Harbor Coats on it otherwise.
Was this like the first song where you're like, okay, I have, like, was there a song in particular when you were coming up with stuff where you're like, okay, I think I have something here. It's time to, let's work on this album.
There were two things kind of happened that around the same time. One was that I was staying at a friend's place and didn't have any instruments with me, and my friends Jenny Mitchell, like Bird City, Jenny Mitchell and Jenny Omnicord, and her partner Scott Haynes, who's a shopkeeper and like does great guitar repair work in town here, they lent me like this scrappy little parlor guitar, and I had it at my friend's place that I was staying at, and I ended up writing the song called Ask Me Everything, which was the first new song I had written in 6 years or so, five, 6 years. And that happened, and I think the same week I found this like cache of like this on like a hard drive, these like demos from 5+ years ago, things that I had just thought I'd lost, that I didn't like, I just hadn't thought about. And then most of those ended up on the record in different versions. Well, you haven't heard the record yet, but
no, just the one.
Yeah, there's a song called What I Do that's from like 6.5-7 years ago, a song called Outbound Only No Return that was like a kind of garage rock song that the Providers did for a little while. And yeah, anyway, so that the both of those things happened, and suddenly it was like, oh, maybe there's stuff here that I could start to work on and make something out of. And then it just became a project that I really like needed at the time, you know, just going through the winter and a bunch of changes, and having something to work on was really good for me.
You touched on a little bit about the different contributions, and what was like, what would you say was the most like, or maybe one of the most unexpected things where you're like, oh, wow, this is, I didn't expect this. I got to use this.
I think my favorite was Daniel Romano.
Okay.
Where he's on Outbound Only No Return. And mm-hmm. It's kind of like a J.J. Cale style, like driving song, you know, like, and I sent it to him like as we had it at that stage. It was mostly complete, and I just asked him to like add whatever he wanted to it. And I didn't know if he was going to play guitar on it or sing or whatever. And I got back this like 8 tracks of layered vocals that sounded like Fleetwood Mac or like Freddie Mercury or something. Like it was this incredible like backing vocal stuff that just mm-hmm. like when Jeff McMurrick and I, Jeff who runs is one half of VD Fix Records, mm-hmm. put out the record, but also has been the engineer and producer I've worked with since Tournament of Hearts, the Cons, like he recorded that record. And so he and I brought it up like, and you know, dropped it into the actual song, and just like howl laughing, like just tears. It was just so amazing and absurd and just beyond what I would have ever done myself. That was one of my favorite moments of making the record, for sure. It was just such a delight, such a Daniel moment.
So we talked a little bit about how we came up with some of the stuff, and I wanted to ask, like, how would you compare, I know there's a difference between the two, but like, how would you compare maybe the recording experience of this album as opposed to Provider, your first one?
Provider was really different because it was pretty much live off the floor. We like had a really simple like band of, it was Mike Brooks on pedal steel, Tyler Belews on upright bass, Rich Burnett on lap steel, and Rich has been my kind of right-hand man forever, and then myself. And we just set up at 6 Nassau, which was Jeff McMurrick's studio in Toronto, and we're live, like pretty much that whole record, which was great. That was a really like eye-opening way to make, because I had a gap in like making records before that, and had burnt out on kind of studio, like spending too much time in a studio and just feeling wasteful. And so Provider was this more stripped down, live, simple, which I value, and I'd like to get back to doing something more like that again. But this record felt more like collage work. Like it was like there were ideas for songs that weren't even like fully realized when I started sending them to people, and then I would get stuff back, and that would change kind of the shape of where things went. I would go to like Tom Hamerton's backyard studio, and we would just sit there and like arrange horns, or like he would play his acoustic piano, and I would just sit there and like be amazed at what he was doing. And I just got these like both remote and like in-person reconnections with people. But again, it felt like piecemeal, which would have psyched me out in the past, but it was just the way it had to happen this time around. It was kind of, and people have gotten so good at that. I think maybe like even 10 years ago, people were just learning to, you know, record in bits and pieces and perform well and not overthink it and not overproduce themselves in those moments. And now like everyone is so good. Everyone works so much like that. It's really wild. I would still love to record like a live thing more again, but it just couldn't be that way with this record. It was more like, yeah, sending postcards back and forth with friends.
You talked about Jeff McMurrick already a bit, but did he work with you on this record as well?
Yeah, although like usually we would work together in a studio, you know, from the beginning of the recording to the end, in the mixing, but this time he just, I think I, like the, I have the best label situation like anyone could ask for. Like I didn't do anything, a new studio record for 9 years. And then I like kind of started, like Jeff was checking in on me just a little bit on a personal level. And I was like, I think I might start recording some stuff. And he's like, okay. And then just left me kind of alone and like to do it. And then we started, I was like, more and more I would be like, well, I, it might actually happen. Like, do you think we could talk about releasing this? And we had like one meeting with Alex Durlach and Jeff and I, and give me a deadline, you know? And they said like, I think it was end of May or maybe even the beginning of May or something. Mm-hmm. And so it was really like maybe 6 weeks to 2 months of just that, of the recording. And then I gave it to them and they were like, okay, we can do it and we can put it out by November. And it's, it, which is almost unheard of now, like to finish a record in May and have it out by November is absurd. And they were, they just did it in this, and it was so supportive, no pressure, and then just stoked. And like when I got back, when I sent Jeff the unmixed but pretty much finished like recordings of the songs in the order that I had imagined them being for the record, he just sent back a text that said, I effing love this record. it was like the most, I guess I had no idea. It was like that one of the most like vulnerable moments is like sending it out to the first person, especially the person where you're hoping will put some money into releasing it. And he, it was just the most lovely, it was like I, exactly what I needed at the moment. So yeah, and I love that label. I think they do really interesting things. Some really neat serendipitous things happened around the record. Like we were, part of it is that the record is the third in like, I always thought of like the Provider, Free Will, and then I wanted to write a third record that kind of completed this set of things mm-hmm. that were mostly in tribute to my daughter, Asa. And all of them, I was hoping would have this marble cover scheme and have die cut letters like we did with the first two records. You know, the first track on Provider is Asa, which is my daughter's first name. The first track on Free Will is Fletcher, my daughter's middle name. And then the first track on this new record is called Web, and it's just this horn piece that we recorded, which is my daughter's last name. So it completes things in that way. But also, so we were talking about this, and I was, Alex is like the design guy, and I was like, can we do the die cut letters again on marble? To kind of finish this motif or whatever, you know, my grand like scheme. And Alex was like, he had sold this business Standard Form that used to be his printing company. He didn't have the die cutter he used to have and like access to it. It was like, it's going to cost way too much. I don't know how we're going to do this. And then I think we had like 3 weeks later, I had another meeting and he's like, I just heard from a friend of mine that he bought my old die cutter and will let us use it for next to nothing to do this for this new record. So it came back to him like right in time to actually make the record, you know, kind of fulfill that ridiculous idea. But it felt, I'm not a everything happens for a reason kind of guy at all. But it was just a very nice moment of serendipity and good fortune, you know?
Wow. Yeah, that's really cool. I just wanted to ask also in regards to, you said it, you always viewed it as a trilogy. Do you think there's any themes maybe that run through it, or maybe any musical similarities that might run through each one? Like, I know there's going to be musical similarities, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. There's a really specific musical thing that we started with Provider, which was this lap steel and pedal steel at the same time in the accompaniment. And that exists, like, it's a pretty unique combination of instruments. And that exists on at least one song in each record. And I think actually it's two on Run With Me and more on, like it's been less on each record, but at least that ties it together in some instrumentation level. I don't know, thematically, it's like more about survival. I mean, it was always, I think a lot, most of the songs are me speaking, like me trying to say something that might be of value to my kid. Like me not knowing what I'm doing most of the time, trying to come to like some succinct like moment of saying something that could be helpful. and that's all, I mean, that's all those, that ties those records together, I think.
No, that's great. And that's also really broad, right? So you can pull different things from each one if you yeah. want.
And the new one, I mean, I think the new one is especially about trying to know oneself amidst change, which is constant, you know, trying to, but especially like big change and intimidating, fearful kind of change, like trying to understand who one is while everything else is always changing. And the last song on the record is, it's my daughter, we misgendered as a boy when she was born, and is transgender, a wonderful 12-year-old young woman. And in the last year, you know, she's experienced a lot of personal change too, but she also, I mean, she took a lot of comfort in like the work of J.K. Rowling, like the Harry Potter world, and then discovered in the last year like Rowling's like transphobia. So the last song on the record I wrote when that happened as a celebration of self-identification and knowing oneself, and it's called She Is Here, and that felt like it really completed the arc of like all of what I needed to say to her for now. I'm not gonna say anything more profound to her. No,
that's it. No, that's actually great. That's really wonderful. I wanted to ask, just because there's an anniversary that recently came up of China Light, 20 years, and I just wanted to ask you a little bit about this album's legacy, and what do you think it is that people respond to so much from that album?
It's funny because that came up in the most classic cons way, like, which was that we had none of us had any idea. Like, it just somebody like sent a text to one of us and was like, "Hey, congrats on 20 years!" And then and then it was apparent to all of us. Like, we had a joking message. Like, same thing happened, you know, the 10th anniversary. I think we were like, nobody planned anything. We didn't know. So yeah, we're still very connected and on great terms. But I don't know. I mean, I that record. So when it was about to come out, like, we had one record out, and then Sub Pop wanted to release this record, wanted to sign us, and we were like, we were going to make a record for Sub Pop, which then became the most intimidating prospect ever. We spent quite a while like making this record, but it felt like all the songs were kind of different, and it wasn't like one solid thing sonically that felt the same from start to finish. And I think we all started overthinking that a bit, and then it came to like the summer of that year, 2003, and we had like remixed it and maybe remastered it, and I felt like we all lost perspective on it, and we gave it to Sub Pop. And then I left. I was like, I'm going away. And I hitchhiked from like Toronto to Vancouver for like 2.5 weeks. I just was like, I'm off. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. And then came back, and it came out. And then suddenly, like, it was like every good thing that you could want to happen to you as a band started to happen. Like, we just, we started to be able to tour. And I think we were all still working day jobs, like, pretty consistently at the time, but gradually we started to be able to tour more and work less. And I don't know. I mean, I have no idea why that record like grabbed people's attention the way it did. I like it, but I still wonder if it's too many things all at once.
I don't think so.
Still have no perspective on it. But it's. I think it's just a unique record. It's just it's a band that has its own identity, and is also very visceral and like committed to what it's doing, and maybe that's it. Yeah,
this album was made in Toronto at Chemical Sound, which unfortunately isn't around anymore.
Yeah, it was recorded at the what I think was called the Woodshed. It was Blue Rodeo Studio, the actual tracking, or the beginning of it. We did most of the tracking at their space, which was like this great kind of open room covered in barn board, and the mixing console was in the room, in the live room, and recorded to 2-inch tape. And then we went to Chemical Sound and like finished the tracking and mixed it there with Rudy and James, who like, basically, like, we started to mix it, and we were like, did we just totally screw up? And then Rudy and James like brought it back and made it all make sense. They completely like made sense of the recordings we had done. Yeah.
So it was done to tape when you made this one. I wanted to ask, like, do you have anything that you can think of just off the top of your head during that time of making those songs, when you were recording, whether it was at Chemical or at the other place?
Two things for sure. The first was, like, I remember tracking Young Lions, like, pretty live off the floor. And Nate Lohr, who I played with for years, like, was visiting, like, popped in to visit and sat there. Like, he had smoked a joint or whatever. And, like, we bashed it out. And, like, at the end of it, Nate just said, "Yes." And it felt like it was a moment, you know, and I'm sure that was what we ended up using. It was just a great, like, live, you know, off the floor run of that song late at night at that Woodshed studio. And then the other part of it was at Chemical. It was Sub Pop released that record, and then Tournament of Hearts as well, and re-released our first record. But also we were on Three Gut Records in Canada, and Three Gut was like a real community label. Like, it was folks from Guelph, many who had spent time in Guelph that moved to Toronto, Royal City, Gentleman Reg, and folks that were in like Sea Snakes and stuff were all like part of this Toronto via or Guelph to Toronto group. And they had a place called 9 St. Patrick, which was like a house that most of the people who were on Three Gut lived at some point. They would have potlucks and just hangouts all the time. Jim Guthrie lived in this little closet-sized room in there and like recorded those like Jim Guthrie records like in that little tiny room. Like it was a really magical community of musicians, and Lisa and Tyler, the women who ran it, were incredible. Like it was just such a, it felt like a community. It felt like a family of people that were doing something interesting together, rather than like one band being, you know, any more interesting than any other. Like so that's all to say, like, that time mixing and like doing the final tracking, like a lot of the stomping and clapping and like stuff on Shine a Light is a bunch of the folks from Three Gut, from the different bands there, and like Hidden Cameras were kind of part of that sort of extended family as well. And like there was just this, like, there were people coming through that I really admired and loved, and who were also doing amazing things at the time, and they would show up en masse like at Chemical and just, you know, record stomps and vocals and stuff. It was really what, you know, I love about music making. Just, yeah, that kind of community feeling is the best.
I think that, yeah, that's definitely present on the album and in a lot of the things that you've done.
I mean, that was the thing. I think with the Cons had a like, you know, we had our individual things that we articulated in that group, and there was a value system, like a shared value system in that band, like that really centered around community and not taking fish for granted, and knowing that everyone who was working to make shows happen and you know, festivals and making posters and you know, writing about music, and it were all part of things in an equal way, really, like in a way that should all be respected and cared for and tended to. Yeah, I'm really grateful. I think that was really important. That's why the band, why we're still friends, why we still can, we, you know, can care for each other, and but we still have a lot of respect for each other, I think.
I was going to ask, and if you wanted to talk a bit about it, being in the Guelph music scene, a bit about Richard LaViolette, who recently passed. Just wanted to ask you about him, and if you wanted to say anything. Or
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm happy. I had a couple opportunities in the last couple of weeks to talk about his music and also getting to be present at the end of his life. Mm-hmm. Richard is a fascinating musician, really, on like incredible force, and really like community driven, DIY minded. Like, I think his entire musical output was free of, like, you know, all the kind of systems of like competition that exist in like trying to make music on a different scale, you know. Mm-hmm. Always like a house show person, always like changing and doing record, like, you know, he would have a country record and then have a band called the Glitter Bombs that were like a glam punk outfit, and it would be released on CDR, and then the next thing would be like this LP on You've Changed Records, like, and then he would do some shows that were all like covers of like Crazy Horse. Like, I think there was a show where he did all of Americana by Crazy Horse. Like, he was always doing stuff that seemed more about the enjoyment than anything, but also just was a masterful songwriter, like one of the greats. I didn't know his stuff. I lived in Guelph in like early 2000s. With Collins, all kind of lived here in a house and did house shows, and then moved to Toronto. I lived in Montreal for a while, and then I moved back here in 2010. And he had put out, like, he had been a force, like, locally, like, that people adored. Like, just people, everybody knew every word to these songs, and I didn't know anything about them. And then there's this Oil Spills record, Richard LaViolette and the Oil Spills, All of Your Raw Materials, that Steve from the Cons, they kind of re-released like on vinyl, but put out like for a kind of on a wider scale. And that came through, like, past into my attention because of working at the radio station. And it was just like the greatest. I feel like I kind of disconnected from like new music a bit. I was a new parent. I just wasn't like investigating new music. And then I heard that, and it was like the greatest collection of songs I had heard in years. Every